officer training program or whatever, you know. This has to do with your personality and building that personality over decades on the basis of Islam.
Exactly.
And on the basis of that kind of school, which is the school of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the school of the Imams.
Exactly.
And looking at their lives and their decision makings and their way of handling situations, and that way of doing things becoming your way of doing things.
Exactly.
Okay, so this is something very rare,
even among
ulama and even among people who are considered great Muslims.
Great Muslims, great scholars.
Is to have that aspect of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the Imams, alayhim salam, as it relates to their social, political decision making.
Exactly.
Which, you know, as everything else, they are masters of that as well. So this is not simply that you would say that they're a prophet in the whatever Western Christian spiritual kind of tradition of, you know, this ascetic in the corner, nothing to do with the world. In fact, what Islam teaches us is that the prophets and the imams were the, you know, greatest and the most capable of political and social leaders.
They are.
In terms of knowing when to do what they have to do and when to also understand the realities that exist in their time and you know, act accordingly.
Exactly.
So there's a famous he used to say this thing. He said, you know, our imams, you know, killed in battle and were killed.
Yes.
The point is that we have this image in Western spirituality, religiosity, where, you know, a prophet or an imam or a religious leader can't be a political or a social or a military leader. Or if it is, it's the exception.
It's an exception.
Whereas in Islam, it's the rule.
It's the rule.
Okay? Again, I mean, if you want to go about the prophets, well, Prophet David and Suleiman, you know,
they were
kings. They were leaders of militaries. You know, so this is, you know, nobody should say that we're making up stuff.
No, we're not.
We're not saying that that's the only thing they did, but this is part of their job, and some of them more than others.
More than others, yes.
So, you know, it is in that school and in that dynasty, if you want to put it, in that chain of leaders that we see Imam acting the way he does and doing the things he does.
Which is really amazing.
Right, and you see it before the revolution in terms of leading the revolutionary movement.
Movement, yeah.
And some of the things he does,
yes,
which completely, you know, just confusing the Shah and the Savak and the Americans and just not knowing what, you know.
No, they hadn't a clue what was
right.
going
so
on.
So in the end, they're like, okay, we've got to exile you.
Yeah.
And then when they're in Turkey, they're like, no, it's too dangerous. Go to Najaf, you know, go to Iraq.
Yes.
In Iraq, they're like, wait a second, he was supposed to go there and, you know, be swallowed up by all the other ulama, you know. And yet he's become one of the main
ustads.
Yeah. Mm. And people are flocking to his teachings, and he has good relations with all the ulama.
Yes, absolutely.
I think for me, some of the key events that show what I'm talking about, or the thing that I think is important.
Yes,
is,
I mean,
is related.
A couple of examples for us.
Right, I think it's related to that transition period where, you know, the Shah has left, and it's time for Imam to come, but we have that Bakhtiari
government that was appointed by the Shah.
Bakhtiari was
right.
there. Shah Bakhtiari was he was appointed as prime minister.
Yes.
And so at that time, you really see his, you know, political vision and capabilities because it is at these moments where people get fooled by the enemy.
Yes.
Where hearts weaken, where people think, hey, we've got what we wanted, let's. And this is how, for example, they, you know, roll back revolutions. If you look at what happened
in Egypt, yes.
If you look at other places throughout history. So, you know, what do you want? If you don't have a real leader,
yeah.
If you don't have a leader in the mold of Ahlul Bayt,
quite.
And not in the mold of the Khulafa, you're not going to really get anywhere.
No. And this is what we're seeing.
And this is the point about Imam, which is, you know, at that time, Bakhtiari gets appointed. There's the so-called, you know, whatever, provisional, transitional. It wasn't provisional. It was like, you know, the new government.
Yes.
People were saying, well, you wanted the Shah to leave, so he's left.
He's left.
Why don't you, you know, you got what you wanted.
Wanted, yes.
Now, this itself shows how naive some of them were, because that's not what Imam wanted.
No.
He certainly didn't
want that for a moment.
That was just the first step.
That was the first step, yes.
Okay, it's not about, okay, the Shah left, let's have some dude, you know, appointed by the Shah who's And, you know, remember Bakhtiar, what kind of person he was. I mean, he was French. He was basically a French guy.
Was he?
Well, he was Bakhtiar, and then he lived in France for most of his life. And
right.
He was part of the,
I wasn't aware of that.
He was part of the French resistance during the war.
Was he?
My yes. God. And his wife was French, and, you know, he was just a French dude masquerading as an Iranian.
Right.
And the French were quite happy to have him there because all these years it was the British or the Americans that had Iran in their hands.
So
and now it was one of their guys.
Guys, Italy.
And remember, Imam was in Paris.
Yes.
You know, the French thinking, you know what, this is a good opportunity for us to, you know, take over Iran.
Take over Iran.
And take it
have
away.
A foothold.
Yeah,
Iran.
Take it away from the Americans.
And the British.
Right.
Yeah.
So these were the things they were thinking. The Americans were thinking, well, if this guy's in power, we'll have the military, because the military always had close relations with the U.S. Even though he's French, at least he's Western aligned. We don't have to worry about the communists and the Russians and the Soviets. And we have our own generals and officers that can, you know, take things into their hands if it gets out of control.
Sure.
So everybody was, Americans and the French were quite happy.
Happy, yes.
They were ready to, you know, make the compromises necessary and, you know, give the Shah whatever, you know, so that he would shut up and go away and, you know, continue as before.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, cheap oil from you, you know, expensive products into your market from us.
Yes.
You know, destruction of your local history and culture and religion, and, you know, our Hollywood, you know, modern culture and whatever into your.
Yes.
So they were quite happy to continue that.
Sure.
And in the end, you know, maintain our bases in the south of the Caspian Sea against the Soviets and all that stuff.
Right.
In terms of the Cold War.
Cold War, yes.
Situation. Maintaining Iran as a fortress.
Bulwark against
the
Soviet
against
Union.
The Soviet south.
Soviet
flank,
south,
whatever.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, preventing them from coming into the Persian Gulf and the oil fields and, you know, whatever. So all this was happening. And basically, a couple points here. The Americans, we've mentioned this before, but it's really worth repeating. It's a very interesting story. Ebrahim Yazdi, who was one of the leaders of the freedom movement, who were, you know, religious, but they really weren't that into Velayat Faqih, and they weren't into the clerical, you know, had the clergy having a part. They were basically, in their view, they were personally religious, but they were secular in the way they viewed you know, religion in politics.
Sure.
They were part of that crew. He was in Paris, and the American always had good relations with the Americans, you know, lived in Houston for many years.
Sure.
Still goes back and forth there. He basically, the Americans sent a message through him to Imam saying that, and he said it himself, this is not something, you know, we're not making stuff up. He said it himself in a BBC program. So, you know, there you go. It's him in BBC program saying this.
Sure.
As the source of what we're saying. He said that the Americans sent a message to Imam through me saying that, you know, just accept the Bakhtiar government and this new government, and, you know, you got what you wanted, the Shah's left, just go to Qom, you know, make your proclamations, but don't get involved in the daily affairs, and Bakhtiar will take care of things. And if you don't do that, we will tell the military to make a coup d'etat, and we will support the, you know, the Savak and the secret police in Iran to arrest all of you guys and execute you. So my question to you is, what would most leaders do at that point?
Compromise.
They would be like, okay, fine. We'll go, we'll do it. So what did Imam say?
He said, I'll declare a jihad.
He said, if you do that, I will declare a jihad.
Which really threw everyone.
Right. Now, it's interesting because, first of all, when Yazdi was saying this on BBC, you could tell after 35, 40, whatever, 36 years, he's still angry.
Mm.
He's still upset that Imam did this.
Because
he was thinking, well, this is what ruined everything, and if we would just had that, and whatever.
Yeah.
All these things. But I think what it shows is basically Imam, you know, not being intimidated. Because he relies on God. He doesn't care about the American army and the Iranian officers and the Savak. And I think it just shows that, you know, when he says that, well, Americans could have been like, okay, fine, let's you know, bring it on.
Yeah,
right?
Bring it on.
But I think they realized that bringing it on with a person like Imam with all those followers and him declaring jihad would mean, you know, they would lose.
They would lose.
So it's not simply about, you know, him standing up. It's him telling them, you're the ones that are going to lose.
If you're going to do this.
It's not about, you know, this is the thing. We, unfortunately, Muslims, and the whole point of what I'm trying to say here is that, you know, what we're lacking in the Muslim world is leaders like Imam.
Yes, that are so decisive.
Okay, which are key to this matter. Our issue has always been, you know, who is the leader of Islam?
Exactly.
Okay, thank God we've had people like Imam. Thank God we have people like the Supreme Leader. Thank God we have people like Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, right?
But they have come out of that.
But and let me just say this. And you know, as that's about it.
That's about it, yeah.
Okay?
Unfortunately.
I mean, we don't really have...
much more than this.
Right, and it's a shame because, you know, if you had 3, 4, 5, 10 other guys like that, a lot of things would be different in the Muslim world.
They would be.
You know, there would... not be as much oppression, there would not be as much injustice, there would not be as much, you know, devious plans and you know, things that are happening with the enemies of Islam and Muslims themselves becoming tools of the enemies of Islam within the Ummah. If you have clear, smart, decisive leadership who understands the events and understands them not only from a worldly perspective but from a Quranic and Islamic perspective.
Which
so
is
when
the
something
key.
Happens, they immediately understand that this is how the Quran is explaining to you what this is. Who understands the consequences in the next world. Who knows what the lines are. Who knows? This is why we talk about Walayat Faqih.
Sure.
Why faqih? Because a faqih knows the rules and the laws.
Laws, yes.
Okay, we don't want just some philosopher or some, you know, great whatever person who can recite the Quran very well.
Yeah.
We're talking about somebody who knows the lines as it relates to what is prohibited and what is allowed in Islam.
Sure.
Because these are reflections of the reality of what is right and what is wrong.
No, exactly.
This is not some random line drawn by God to annoy us and to make life difficult for us.
No.
It's a reflection of what is actually... right and wrong. When you're talking about how you deal with non-Muslims, there are laws concerning that.
Yes.
When you're dealing with, you know, war and how you deal in war, there are laws concerning that, and you need to know these things.
Exactly.
And because they are reflections of the reality of whether you're going to be successful or not.
Exactly.
Again, I use the example of the chemical weapons. Well, people say you should have used chemical weapons. We say no, we shouldn't have. And in fact, in the long run, this was good for us.
Sure.
We didn't use chemical weapons when they attacked us with chemical weapons. And in the long run, this was of great benefit to the Islamic Republic.
Let's not...
And we're not even mentioning the otherworldly aspects of it, of not having used these weapons on other human beings, which who knows what the...
Yeah, the consequences
of that will be in the next world.
But to be honest, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, I mean, let us not forget the fact that Iran in the 1980s had the capability of retaliating on a mass scale with Iraq. I mean, the thing not only was the fact that Imam was so visionary in terms of even how he reinvented the army. You know, I mean, he created the besiege forces. He created
all kinds of institutions.
Which I think to this day, you know, terrify
and
the
United
States of America.
I think you make a good point. And the army is a good point. And let me get to that
Please.
In a moment.
Yeah, yeah.
This is another example, a very good example that you put. Once he is in Iran... Mm. So first, he is not intimidated by the threats of the Americans about, you know, accept this. And he comes to Iran, he gets off the plane, and he goes to Beishtara, and he says, you know, in very not usual for a
clergyman.
He says, I will sock this government into the mouth with, you know.
Yes.
Okay, basically why? Because this is... it's not a legal government.
It's not a legal government.
It was appointed by a person who himself was not legally allowed to rule.
Rule, yes.
Okay, as a king, you know, in a coup d'etat by his father, there's no legal basis. The only legal basis is if there is a, you know, hukm by the ulama allowing that ruler, whether it's the ulama themselves or another ruler being appointed by the ulama or being
approved. And this is also another point that, you know, which you quite nicely inferred to, which is the fact that the Imam Khomeini saw the validity of the entire system of Iran through the ballot box. So
through Islam,
yes.
In the sense that you saw what happened in Egypt.
Yeah.
These guys came into power, the so-called Islamists, and yet they were playing the game of the previous regime.
Exactly.
So with the same rules, they overthrew them.
Exactly.
So Imam said, I don't even play your game.
Game.
It doesn't matter who appointed you. That person who appointed you was not legitimate to begin with. So you're not legitimate.
Legitimate, yes.
Get out of here. Okay. Yeah. And he said it. And so at that time, they declared military rule.
Mm.
They said after, I think, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, nobody's allowed to be in the streets.
Right.
Okay. Which was ridiculous. I mean, what is that supposed to mean?
Sure.
Right. And they were saying, oh, we're going to send the military. Anybody out will be shot, blah, 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 all that stuff.
Mm.
At that, so that level, he's not intimidated by this threats by the U.S. He comes to Iran. He says that I'm going to sock them in the mouth and we're going to create our own government.
Exactly.
I will appoint a government, mm. which was then the Revolutionary Council, and then which later, 2 months later, you had the first elections and the elections for the Constitutional Assembly. And so what is the reaction of the government? They declare martial law.
Sure.
And they say nobody's allowed to leave, be in the streets after 4 o'clock.
Sure.
So what does Imam do?
He says, come out in the streets.
I mean,
yeah.
I think this is maybe even more hardcore than, you know, standing up to the American.
This is the point we're trying to make here, that Imam Khomeini does those things which really, you know, stunned everybody. Nobody knew how to react. I mean, they were just confused.
You know, this one was so intense that even some of the ulama around him were like, hey, wait a second.
Wait a minute.
You know, well, this is going to be a problem.
This is going to be a sauce.
And he said, it's not going to be a problem.
People
came out. It wasn't, yes, there were some shootings, but it wasn't that mass.
That mass slaughter.
You know,
because
you got to remember at that time, I mean, these people who were running it, whether it was the security services, the army, they themselves were, half of them, revolutionary.
Sure.
Most of the army, this brings me to the army, because we were talking about the
army.
Yes, yes. So it wasn't like they were these, you know, guys just trigger happy waiting to kill their fellow brothers and sisters and cousins and aunts and uncles.
Sure.
I mean, they're all part of the same society.
Society, yes.
So Imam realizes this.
Yes, so he knows this, yeah.
Okay.
He knows, unlike
Bakhtiar and unlike, you know, General so-and-so and, you know...
These elites who hate
officer,
the people.
You know, Colonel so-and-so in the U.S., he realizes that, you know, these are the same people. They're not going to shoot each other.
Right?
So 4 o'clock rolls around and he says, okay, everybody go out. And they go out.
Yeah.
And the whole dynamic changes.
Exactly.
Because there's no shootings. There's no mass killings. I mean, there's no mass killings. There's some shootings, but there's no mass killings. You see the demonstrators putting the
flowers,
carnations into the rifles. And, you know, basically half the army, you know, coming over to
to Imam Khomeini.
Right? I mean, you know, the army suddenly, you see like all the enlisted men, basically all of them from, you know, poor religious backgrounds are like, hey, we're not going to do something that's against what Imam has ordered.
Order.
You know? So.
Fantastic.
This is another aspect. The army itself, another of the brilliant moves of Imam. Many people in the revolutionary movement demanding the abolition.
Abolition, dismemberment of the army.
Of the army. Imam, from day one, said, we're not going to do this.
Do that.
You know, this is our army. We need this army. It's part of our power. It's part of our ability to defend our borders. This is, you know, they are our own sons. He had this famous line. He said, Agha means Lord, you know, master. He said, you can be your own masters. You don't need the American advisors. You yourself are capable of doing all these things.
Yes.
And we saw that in the war, this was the case.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So from the very beginning, he knew that he has to, you know, that the army is not separate from the people. This is very important because the Shah has desperately claimed trying to turn the army into his own personal army.
Personal army.
So what he would do is he would, you know, get those officers, those generals, and those colonels that were, you know, very loyal to him. They would give him extra privileges and so on and so forth. But what he didn't realize is that the body of the army was, you know, the normal enlisted men, the junior officers.
Of course they were.
Even some of the higher-ranking officers.
Yeah.
Who
were all of the people.
Were from the people.
Mm.
But Imam understood this, unlike many of the revolutionary forces who didn't, who said this has to be, you know, dissolved and we will be the new army and so on and so on and so forth. At the same time, he's smart enough to realize, well, the revolution needs its own army as well, so he creates Sepah.
He creates
the Revolutionary Guards.
Yes.
So these are all examples of capable, visionary, decisive leadership by somebody who's leadership training, if you want to put it that, whose leadership course was, you know, conducted by the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Where this is the key here.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't, you know, didn't go to university, some Western university. He didn't go to some officer training school. He didn't go to some, you know, management guru who was going to tell him what to do, which unfortunately we see a lot of Muslims, you know, they're Muslim. They do everything in their life as Muslims. And then when it comes to these things, they're like, well, what does the management theory tell us?
Come on. Exactly.
Go and see how the Prophet did things. Look at how the Imams, you know, managed the affairs.
Yes.
And you do it the same way.
Exactly.
With the same spirit, with the same understanding. Of course, it takes time to understand it, to read it, to learn it. So this is not something that happens overnight. Your personality.
But the results are amazing.
One's personality is also a factor in it. Yes. Some people are born leaders. Others are, you know, less so.
Yes.
So if you have those abilities, you need to do it in the school of Ahlul Bayt in order to be a real Muslim leader.
One other key point that, you know, you remind me of in terms of what you said about, you know, the people coming out at 4 o'clock when Bakhtiar had declared martial law in Iran. And that, for me, you know, is also key in terms of the Quranic thinking of the Imam. Mm-hmm. Because he comes right out of the Quran, you know.
Right.
It's right out of the verses of the Quran. Because, you know, first of all, martyrdom is not something that is a death or an end for somebody. This is the beginning of something far greater, something much more. And this is what he tells the Americans, that, look, don't threaten me.
Right.
Don't do that to me.
Right.
We are people who are going to sit here and to the last drop of my blood will fight for what we believe in.
Exactly.
And if you do that to us, you will see an earthquake in this region like you've never seen it before.
Right.
And these people are going to lay down their lives for what they believe in, and you are going to be the loser. He said, fear is not in our vocabulary.
Yeah.
It's our enemies who are fearful.
He said, you people who have God, what are you scared of?
What are you scared of? Exactly. Why does fear enter
you? You have God.
You have God.
Right?
Trust
and
in
this
God.
Was important, I think, in the history of Islam. And in terms of, you know, the growth of Islam and the revival of Islam is to have a leader like him who reminded us of what the Quran really tells us.
Fearless leaders,
you know, millions and millions and tens of millions of Muslims, they recite the Quran every day, but do they think about it,
what they're saying?
You know, recitation is a good thing.
Yes, we all should do it.
I'm not saying we shouldn't do it.
But
the key is that when you recite it, you think about what the Quran is saying.
Mm.
So this is what Imam did in the most clear and beautiful way.
Mm.
He said, you know, this is what we're going to do. And again, remember, you know, in this case that we talked about in terms of him managing the army during the revolution, this just shows the moderation that he actually had.
Mm.
That he wasn't this, you know, radical dude who was just going to come and throw everything up.
Throw everything out, right?
The main instrument of the Shah's power, which was the army, he, contrary to the pressures that were put on him by the other revolutionary forces, said, no, we're going to keep them. They're our sons. They are part of us.
Mm.
You know, it's not about throwing everything into the garbage.
No.
It's about reforming.
Revamping it.
And reforming. This is what Islam does. Islam doesn't...
Exactly.
This is the way Islam does it.
Exactly.
Islam doesn't come with the...
Because that's why that photograph, that very famous Ionic image that I remember with the Air Force all saluting the Imam.
Well, basically,
this was...
Exactly. And that's really the turning point in the revolution.
It was.
Where basically, because the Air Force was, even within the military branches, the Air Force was
Because they were
like,
all trained by the Americans.
Right. They were considered the elite of the elite.
Elite of the elite.
They were considered... They were all like, you know, trained by the Americans. This was where all the best equipment went. This is where everything, you know, the top officer candidates goes to the Air Force. So the Air Force was the top.
Sure.
And here you have all these Air Force. It was about 300 of the Air Force officers coming and pledging allegiance to Imam.
Exactly.
In full uniform.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And the thing was that, of course, that Ionic image, as I say, was so powerful, so significant, because it played a vital role in the 8-year holy defense.
Well, it also was a message to the Americans and the world that you can't rely on the army or the air force to, you know, make a coup d'etat and, you know, pull the out of the fire, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It was basically them saying, you know, we who are all Western American trained, who speak fluent English, and, you know, who you were counting on to be your, you know, main agents in Iran forever.
Yes, I just made pay it to
We just pledged allegiance to
the Imam.
Okay? So it was not only internally important, it was internationally very important.
Exactly.
So this is the lessons that we can learn from all that.
Thank you, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, for that valuable contribution on the man who changed the world. Really, it was a very powerful contribution there. Thanks very much for that, as it always is. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners, and I hope they enjoyed the program. And it leaves me to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Hello and welcome to The Light. If you walk through London these days, you will spot tiny handmade shops in some places. The shops have been created by an artist to encourage people to donate non-perishable food to charities. Sean Rodrigo makes wooden miniature food banks and puts them in different areas. He uses a 3D printer to create his artwork. Rodrigo believes decorated boxes shaped like shops grab people's attention. Each box holds about 35 cans.
Now, after an unprecedented winter storm in some parts of the United States, people in Texas have a rush to rescue sea turtles. So the creatures are not used to chilly weather, so they became cold stunned. This is a condition in which sea turtles remain awake but lose the ability to move. Volunteers have so far saved over 4,700 of them off the southern coast of Texas. The rescued turtles were transferred to a convention center and will be freed after the water becomes warmer. How would the Milky Way look like if it fell from the sky? Maybe similar to a magnificent scenery created by the freezing temperature in northeastern China. Frozen waterfalls in China's Jingpo Lake present a stunning view that attracts visitors even during the coldest days of the year. The chilly weather freezes the waterfalls from side to side with thick layers that are up to 15 meters high. The icy layers cover the cliffs, and they are sometimes as wide as 300 meters. But surprisingly, and unlike the waterfalls, the lake itself never freezes and is ice-free all around the year. That is because of its underground hot springs. Italy witnessed an amazing natural scenery. This one, however, is all about heat and smoke. Footage taken from Italy's Mount Etna shows thick plumes of rose-colored smoke rising into the sky while red lava turning the mountain slope into a glowing river. Europe's tallest active volcano burst into a new eruption earlier this week in the Sicilian town of Catania. Despite a rain of stones and ashes, authorities said the eruption has not been worrying. Mount Etna has erupted frequently in the past 500,000 years. Its last major eruption was back in 1992.
It's really difficult and often painful to put a smile on kids' faces, especially when they're sick and they are suffering from chronic diseases. But a group in superhero costumes in Austria has taken a courageous move to cheer up young patients on International Childhood Cancer Day. Vienna's Special Forces police officers agreed to visit the children's hospital dressing up as Spider-Man, Batman, and other superheroes. The young patients were excited and delighted to see them through windows while they scrawled on the walls of the hospital. The officers' brass band also played familiar songs from Star Wars to amuse the children. The visit was planned by hospital officials and volunteer officers in order to cheer up these little warriors who are fighting the diseases every day.
Thai brides and grooms have said, "I do," in a special wedding ceremony on Valentine's Day. 59 couples tied the knot on elephants during the ceremony in Thailand's Chonburi province. The elephant-back wedding is actually an annual event. It takes place in a botanical garden. In previous years, over 100 couples attended the ceremony. But this year, the number was half that due to the pandemic.
Humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage of the winter and having a blast playing in the snow. Bao Di and Bao Mi, translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pairi Diaza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of a panda is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to five giant pandas. Pairi Diaza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of a botanical garden and an animal theme park.
Chinese villagers cook local dishes as they mark the start of the Lunar New Year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated throughout East Asia and has always been the most important holiday of the year in that region. For many people, it's a two-week celebration culminating in fireworks, red envelopes with gifts, and most importantly, a sumptuous feast. The elaborate meal preparation allows the family to spend more time together and celebrate the New Year. The auspicious symbolism of these traditional foods is based on their pronunciations and appearances. Not only do the dishes themselves matter, but also the preparation and ways of serving and even enjoying them mean a lot. In the northwestern province of Shanxi, villagers use a 3,000-year-old recipe to make huamou, a kind of floury steamed bun in a variety of festive shapes, including Chinese zodiacs. As you know, 2021 is the lunar year of the ox.
Australia is offering environmentally friendly kayak tours in Sydney Harbour to both entertain participants and help clean up the ocean. The tours offer paddles, buckets, sieves and picker sticks for removing trash from the harbour. Each month about 20 such tours take place. They collect around 200 kilograms of garbage. Organisers believe big changes can be made with these tiny steps.
I do feel like we make a difference. It's not—I don't feel like it's just about the rubbish that we pick up, but I feel like it's about sharing a message of what we're doing, and I guess teaching people about recycling, using less plastic. I think a lot of people walk around the boardwalk and think that Sydney Harbour is beautiful and pristine, and it is a very clean waterway compared to others in the world. But once you're down here in a kayak or if you go for a swim, you really notice just how much rubbish is down there. So I think it opens people's eyes up.
Plastic pollution has a direct and deadly effect on wildlife. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, 8 million tons of plastic goes into the ocean globally each year. Experts say that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the ocean. People throughout China and in many countries across the globe have begun celebrations marking the start of Chinese Lunar New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. February the 12th is the beginning of the Year of the Ox. Based on the Chinese calendar, a variety of activities featuring traditional Chinese culture and folk performances mark the occasion in China and neighboring states Malaysia, Japan, and Vietnam. Releasing lanterns and setting off fireworks are part of the event. It's also the time for families to be together as the day starts with a week-long official public holiday. The festive mood is also seen in Europe as well as in Australia. Sydney was one of the first cities to kick off celebrations.
It's meant to be a year of economic prosperity, which we need after COVID, a year of good health, which we need so we can, you know, mix and get back to a normal way of life. But it would be good if we have good relations with all of our neighbours.
The Italian city of Milan also joined the celebrations, with its highest building being lit up in red for the fourth consecutive year. Every year, millions of people in China and elsewhere in the world welcome and celebrate the Spring Festival. The occasion attracts hundreds of thousands of tourists to China. However, border closures and travel bans due to the COVID-19 pandemic have reduced the crowd this year, forcing many people to sit home and watch the festivities online.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xinming used clay to make a sculpture of an ox this year, the symbol of the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It is almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says that the piece aims to lift the spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It is adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says that he will put the ox in public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on yet another episode of The Lantern. In life, we will always be faced with situations that demand a great measure of assessment and evaluation from us. There are numerous narrations from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, which advise us with great emphasis to think whatever we want to do through. This does not necessarily mean that we have to become cowardly in life and timid and overcautious and not be able to take chances and risks. But a person who tries throughout their life to develop a sense of awareness regarding themselves first and foremost, and the situation and conditions around them, and constantly strives to prioritize Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His satisfaction in everything they do, like we've mentioned in so many episodes before, will develop a furqan within themselves. A person who lives in that state of awareness constantly will always be careful not to make stupid mistakes. But then again, we're human, and things happen in life that we wish they hadn't. I forgot to listen to a short story. I forgot for us to listen to a short story. Let's do that, and we'll be right back.
The whistle is the title of today's story on Lantern. 200 years ago, there lived in Boston a little boy whose name was Benjamin Franklin. On the day that he was 7 years old, his mother gave him a few pennies. It was the first money that he had ever had. "You may buy something if you wish," said his mother. "You must be careful not to spend these foolishly." The little fellow ran into the street. As Benjamin ran down the street, he wondered what he should buy. But there were 14 boys and girls older than he and two little sisters who were younger. What a big family he was, and the father was a poor man. No wonder the lad had never owned a toy. He had not gone far when he met a larger boy who was blowing a whistle.
"I wish I had that whistle," he said.
The big boy looked at him and blew it again. "Oh, what a pretty sound it made."
"I have some pennies," said Benjamin.
"You may have them if you will give me the whistle, all of them."
"Yes, all of them."
"Well, it's a bargain," said the boy, and he gave the whistle to Benjamin and took the pennies. Little Benjamin Franklin was very happy, for he was only 7 years old. He ran home as fast as he could.
"See, mother," he said, "I have bought a whistle."
"How much did you pay for it?"
"All the pennies you gave me."
"Oh, Benjamin," one of his brothers asked to see the whistle. Well, well, he said. You've paid a dear price for this thing. It's only a penny whistle, and a poor one at that. The little boy saw what a mistake he had made. Never mind, my child, said his mother very kindly. The lesson you have learned today is never to pay too dear for a whistle. Benjamin Franklin lived to be a very old man, but he never forgot that lesson.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So the story is about Benjamin Franklin. Now, I personally would not take Benjamin Franklin as my role model. Not just because we have so many other great role models, whether infallible, whether our scholars, whether our elites and great thinkers or philosophers, but also because, well, I don't necessarily agree with his worldview. But that doesn't mean that he did not have certain wisdoms of his own. And there's a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam where His Eminence says, don't look at who says it. Look at what is said. And of course, this hadith must be taken into context. But in this context, I think it would be safe for us to contemplate on this life experience that Benjamin Franklin went through. And it was so crucial to him that it stuck in his mind throughout his life. And it created, it formed many of the decisions he made in his future years. It's very interesting as well. I was reading a letter he had written to one of his friends regarding the matter of not spending too much on a whistle. And at the end of the letter, he says, in short, I conceive that great part of the miseries of mankind are brought upon them by the false estimates they have made of the value of things, and by their giving too much for their whistles. And I think this is a wise word that we can take from whoever says it. And the fact that we have verses in the Quran and a hadith from the Ahlul Bayt that back that up gives it validity. We honestly do that a lot in life. As a matter of fact, we do that toward life itself. We give it too much value. We stress upon it too much. We think about it too much. We struggle and strive and endeavor for it too much. And we forget that this life is just a bridge. It's not our destination and purpose. We're meant for something and somewhere greater and other than this world. As Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, وَالْآخِرَةُ خَيْرٌ وَأَبْقَى. The afterlife is better and is more and is everlasting. This world is fleeting, and it doesn't make sense if we really put things into perspective for a person to invest on the bridge. Sure, a person, we talked about being cautious, how our religion tells us to be cautious, to think things through before making an attempt, and a cautious person would invest in building themselves a steady bridge. But a steady bridge for what? A steady bridge that would not fall and crumble while they are trying to pass it in order to get to the other side. It is upon me as a Muslim, as a God-wary person, a person who is trying to live in a state of self-awareness, a person who strives to be a better version of themselves constantly. It's reasonable for me to try to put my efforts into things that I know will last for me always. Now, we just said that this world is fleeting. It does not last. Tops 80 years. So 2 plus 2 equals the long-lasting thing I have to be investing in is in my afterlife. And I need to fortify anything in this world that would help me achieve that objective. I need to be very careful not to make false estimates about the value of this world. I need to be aware that certain things in this world are really valuable, but they are valuable in terms of how they would serve my afterlife. Thank you for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
أنا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Salamun alaikum. Welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. We have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Salamun alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Salma Khalfan.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
You're welcome. So, Sister Salma Khalfan, for the past few sessions, you've been answering this question. So, I'll just repeat the question once more for the audience. So, the question was, how do we abstain from domestic quarrels at home? And what effect does it have on the upbringing of the children? And, of course, later on, how do we avoid such conflicts?
Yeah.
So you've mentioned quite a few points on how it affects the children, you know, mentally, physically, emotionally, and how we should try and avoid them, you know, not fight in front of them, and the experiences that you mentioned.
Yeah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Basically, we are looking at the scenarios that happen of how these parents have these quarrels amongst themselves and then what affects them. So each child each experience teaches us that, you know, our children might be in the same boat.
Yeah.
But we don't know about it probably,
yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
And what if he or she turns out to be an adult who carries all these memories and probably has, you know, acts nervously or is lonely and maybe depressed mm. or not being able to set up a home for themselves in future mm-hmm. or even in their, you know, like in their own lives with their married, you know, spouses or something.
Mm-hmm.
So all this thing is giving a lesson to us that we should start by ourselves to bring up our children in such an amicable manner that they should not become adults of, you know, like who would have such an attitude of quarrelsome nature.
Yeah, true.
Yep. So one of the other experiences that age 5, one of the letters that somebody writes to psychiatrists,
okay.
age 5 is the best part of one's childhood. And mm-hmm. it is, actually. Age 5 is when you come to understand and you start having fun and mm-hmm. you know, realize that, you know, you're getting the love and you also reciprocate it mm-hmm. together.
Age so before five, that, it's just like one yeah. way. Or you
it's
don't
just
really
that you don't understand some yeah. things, you know. Yeah. But age 5 is start realizing and mm-hmm. understanding mm-hmm. some principles, okay. you know. Mm-hmm. A child does understand and mm-hmm. Understands that he's being loved. Yeah. Understand if he's not being loved. All okay, these things, he gets yes. the picture mm-hmm. that I'm not getting enough attention. He asks for it. He wants to have playtime and mm-hmm. fun time with mm-hmm. his parents. He wants to communicate and have strong relationship with his parents, you know.
Yes.
He starts missing the parents also when they're away from home. Mm-hmm. Age 5 is that mm-hmm. kind of age. So he's saying age 5 is the best part of one's childhood. When I was of this age, there came about a bitter difference between my parents.
Okay.
My father brought a second wife. Because of these differences, my mother secured a divorce from my father. We were 6 brothers and sisters.
Mashallah.
One day turned very bitter for us. I was playing with one of my brothers when our mother came to say that now she's going away.
Oh,
she's
no.
just leaving them. God knows how sad we children
six
were.
Brothers and
all of a sudden, that the parent comes and says, I have to leave the house and I have to leave you to your father.
Yeah.
Because 6 children, how will she support them, right? She doesn't have anywhere to go, probably a friend. So our mother went away and we remained with our father and our new mother. We remained away from our mother for 2 years and bearing the pangs of negligence that our father showed to us.
Mm,
because of course
so
he'll
sad.
Pay attention to the new wife more, right? You know, if you go and see why did these quarrels happen due to the selfish nature of the parents.
Mm.
And the father even played a role in that selfish nature.
Exactly, yeah.
So then he will remain selfish, right? So, of course, because the wife is providing his needs for him,
mm.
so he will pay more attention to the wife rather than the children. Although it's a sad contrast that he even loves the children because they're part of his existence.
Yeah, but then at that point, he kind of
neglects them. He can't show them,
yeah,
and he doesn't even know. Probably this is the last thing in his mind. One day, our mother came back to me and took one of my brothers home, and she had received some legacy from her mother's property, like a kind of an inheritance. So with that inheritance, she, you know, could keep us.
Okay.
And then I'll continue, inshallah.
All right, okay. Let's take a break, dear listeners. Stay tuned and don't go away. We'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Yes, this is Salma Khalfan. You were just mentioning something and I interrupted.
Yeah, so this child says that one day my mother got an inheritance.
Okay.
And she could now support us. So we all, brothers and sisters, we joined our mother in her care, under her care, and our mother gave us the best treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So now this shows that also a mother is sometimes under the influence of a father, the husband,
mm-hmm.
and she also retorts in a negative way such mm-hmm. that children can be affected. So now the mother had now given a solution to herself that she will give even the father's love to the children.
Mm.
But we cannot forget what scars
yeah,
that we bore
it never
due
away.
To the second mother. Mm. So that feeling of getting the second mother in their mm. life, the stepmother, mm. will never be erased from
yeah.
our minds.
I don't know if this experience is from like a Muslim person or not, but even though Islam does allow you to have, you know, 4 wives, but I guess sometimes we have to see in what situation. It's not like just because you're allowed, you can just bring another wife at any time.
And then, of course, when you're allowed to even, it doesn't mean that you have to take away the children from the mother and, you know, leave the mother helpless without any way to support her children.
True, yeah.
At least get two houses for them, each living separately. Eh? Mm-hmm. It's better that way.
Yeah.
Oh, so all these things like, you know, left this very state in the mind of the children that now they hate the feeling of stepmothers ever, or the fact that they can ever accept another woman in a man's life. So this is like, in a way, it has affected the children in a very you know, detrimental ways, that they can't even accept the Sharia too easily. That I don't believe in such things.
It's true,
that
actually,
all the stepmothers that come treat badly. They don't know that doesn't happen.
I think it's just sat in our, like,
it's a culture, probably. Culture, you know, that said, sometimes in a culture it sets up, but that's not the case, of course. I myself, when I was a child, my mom passed away quickly, so my dad married another woman, and alhamdulillah, this woman was so great. Until now, we as, like quite middle-aged people, she writes to us and she communicates, and she's so good. But of course, I can't say that a mother can, you know, be in the place of a mother. She can be a very good friend. But doesn't mean that stepmothers are bad people, right? But look, in their psyche came this notion that stepmothers are very bad. And this concept is a wrong concept altogether. This is the repercussion of quarrelsome nature that lives in the delicate mind of a child. Maybe I can say one more experience. Another lady writes that my parents always used to quarrel and there was turmoil at my home. My mother always used to be angry. I was 8 years of age when she used to leave my other siblings in my care and go out. She was frustrated. She didn't know what else to do. She used to go and have her own outlets. My sister and brothers were age 2, 4, and 6, such tender ages. I used to take care of them to the best of my capability, but I was young as well, so I couldn't do much for them. And sometimes I used to get beatings from my father that I didn't take care of my siblings in the way I should have. So imagine that burden that comes in a child,
when the then she feels that guilt when she's not even supposed to be feeling, because
It's not her duty and responsibility the way it is the duty of the mother. But the mother pent up emotions and left the house. Leaves the house for her own outlets. Her mother's place, her siblings' place, her friend's place, and there go the poor kids.
All right. Thank you, Sister Samla Khalfan. Let's take a break, dear listeners. Stay tuned and don't go away.
Ya muqiy al khayrat, ya muqiy al khayrat.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sister Salma Khalfan, you were talking about these little kids who had bad experiences during their childhood and the effects, very, very bad effects they have, I think, throughout their lives. Then it just stays with them, and I think it's very, very sad and unfortunate, though, that any parent could do that to their child. Maybe it's unintentional, but I guess it's still unfortunate and sad.
You know, there comes a point in time that it's not unintentional also. It's just a selfish nature that I don't care whatever people do, whatever, that's even true, my children. I can't stop myself. So this is not very unintentional, I feel. You have them.
Maybe it starts unintentionally, but as it goes ahead, you know it's affecting the children, but you still don't want to stop.
It's the satanic energy that never stops because it has a platform. So, despite all the difficulty, this girl says, I was trying to continue my studies. I thought that I'd be something. But I failed. Because why? The pressure. There's so much pressure in a child's mind when they can't even perform, you know, properly
it
in education.
Everything, yes.
And so, I didn't perform well. My tutors were aware of my difficulties. They took pity on me and gave me grace marks. But that didn't help me in the long run. In such circumstances, I reached high school. Now I'm also a mother. I make a sincere effort that differences do not plague me and my family. So I don't want to learn this lesson in a bad way. Because I suffered so much, you know, in my education.
There's some who take, like, positive lessons from their lives. and make a good life out, you know, their new
life. But just imagine the most productive part of her